Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting new books, and we interview the authors of those books. This week I'm very pleased to say we have Dorothy Crawford on the show, and we'll be talking about her book, Virus Hunt, The Search for the Origin of HIV. Most people think of history as the history of humans, and I think quite properly, but there are histories of other things. And Dorothy has written a book about one of those other things, namely the HIV virus. And in so doing, she has kind of expanded the boundaries of history. Because yes, as I say, viruses too have histories. And this one is very interesting, and so is the detective work that went into finding out when it jumped to humans, and in fact, when it first invested, if I might put it that way, chimpanzee populations in Africa. Some of the mechanisms and techniques that the biologists who are at the center of our story used are going to be a little bit unfamiliar to everybody, but I think that in the course of time, we'll be able to explain them so that the story becomes clear. In any event, I want to thank Dorothy for writing the book, and I want to welcome her to the show. Welcome to the New Books Network, Dorothy.
Well, thank you. That's very kind.
Dorothy, could you begin the interview by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yes. Well, I qualified in medicine as a doctor, but fairly quickly went into research and became a research virologist. I've worked all my life, all my professional life, on a virus called Epstein-Barr virus. So I don't want to give the impression that the work in this book is my work, because it isn't, actually. It's the work of colleagues. So obviously I've always kept an interest in HIV, and I did a little bit of work on it at the beginning. But I'm a research virologist working on this herpes virus, Epstein-Barr virus. I had the chair of medical microbiology at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. And then in 1997, I moved to Edinburgh to take the chair of medical microbiology at the university there. Mm-hmm. I don't quite remember how I got into writing popular science books. Anyway, it's a long time ago. but I wrote one, and after every one I write, I say, right, that's it. Don't anybody let me write another book. But somehow I just seem to get into it again. I don't seem to be able to stop. So this is my third popular science book, I think. And I've written others about the history of medicine in Edinburgh, for example, as well.
Mm-hmm. I keep promising my wife that I'll never write another book. And I keep promising myself that I'll never write another book, because
I know
they just don't pay. I don't have
I'm not that bothered about that, but it's just so exhausting, sort of draining.
Yeah, it really is. Absolutely.
The whole thing. But, having said that, I obviously enjoy it, because I keep doing it.
Yeah, there's something in it. It's sublime, I think, is what we would call it. Writing books is sublime.
Yeah, it's
painful,
nice when
but
it
rewarding.
Works.
All right. Could you tell us why you wrote Virus Hunt, The Search for the Origin of HIV?
Yes. Well, as I say, it's not the virus I work on, but I did do some work on it very early on in the 1980s, and then I carried on with my own virus. So it was actually when I moved to Edinburgh, and there was a specific, it was stimulated by going to a talk by Professor Paul Sharp, who features in the book. He's an evolutionary biologist, and he's the one who's put all the evolutionary trees together for HIV and discovered where it came from and when it jumped to humans and things. So I was just so excited by this talk I went to, and absolutely fascinated by the sort of detective story that he told of work over 30 years or so that finally tracked down, where the virus came from and when it jumped to humans and then what it did after that. I just thought it would make an absolutely fascinating book.
Well, it did make an absolutely fascinating
book. Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear this.
Yeah, the best way to write a good book is to start with a good story and good material.
I think that's
and
right,
so
yeah,
you deserve a lot of credit for that. You picked a really good one. Why? Let me ask this. Why, one might ask, do we really care about the origins of HIV? I mean,
yes,
I can understand spending a lot of money on the cure and things, but who cares where it came from?
Well, I think we should care a lot about where it came from, because if we're ever going to try and stop another such thing happening, mm-hmm. we need to know exactly where it came from and, how it got into the human population. And in this particular case, because it had been around for so long in Africa before we ever discovered it, it was actually very difficult to trace it back. But if we don't know where they come from, it's like the flu virus, for example. We know that it comes from birds, a new strain of flu, and therefore we can monitor what's going on in birds mm-hmm. and predict when we might get another pandemic. And so, you know, we should be doing the same with all viruses, really, finding out where they come from and trying to stop them.
I think that's terrific. We should, I don't recommend hiring historians as they're currently trained to do that work.
No, okay, fair enough.
I wish historians could do it. Work. Yeah, I think so, too. I absolutely agree with you. So you begin your story with the discovery, if that's the right word, of the HIV virus itself. And I just to tell a little anecdote, I remember giving blood in Seattle, Washington, in the United States, and I believe it was 1982. Mm-hmm. And at the blood bank, they had a sign that said, if you are Haitian or have recently been to Haiti, you can't give blood.
Yes.
I don't know if you remember this, but it was associated with Haiti at the time. Yeah, and then it became the gay disease for a while. I didn't make the association at all until years after, obviously. But how was it discovered that the cause of AIDS is HIV, and who's responsible for that, and how did they do it?
Well, obviously, as the disease came along, it looked as if it was probably caused by a virus. I mean, it wasn't absolutely settled, but to the virologist anyway, it looked as if it was caused by a virus, and it was obviously infectious and spreading within populations. And so I guess almost every group of virologists were trying to isolate a virus from infected material, from, you know, patients. And I guess the team in France, in Paris, were the ones who just happened to get the virus first. And in the book I addressed, there was a lot of controversy going on as to who actually first isolated the virus. There was a team in the United States and a team in France. But I think, you know, I wasn't involved in that, but eventually it has been settled, I think, that the French team isolated it first.
Mm-hmm. So
not that it matters, you know.
No,
it doesn't
really
matter who isolated it first. What matters is that we then had the virus. You know, and so we could develop diagnostic tests, we could trace the virus, you know, we could tell who was infected and who wasn't, and, you know, that was a huge breakthrough.
Mm-hmm. So give us some understanding of what it means to isolate the virus. I know a little bit about it. Viruses are, well, tell us what a virus is and how they are how they are divided into types.
Well, viruses are absolutely unique, and they are tiny, obviously. I mean,
they're beyond tiny.
By tiny, yeah. I mean, you can't see them down a light microscope. You need an electron microscope
to
see them.
Yeah.
They're so, like, you know, a few microns. And basically, whereas we've got like 20,000 genes or something, they've got between 2 and 100 or something like that, you know, most of them anyway. So they are tiny. Every other living, in inverted commas, organism is made up of cells. Viruses are particles. And so there is a huge debate about whether they really are living or not at the moment among scientists. But anyway, whether they are or not, they're particles that can do absolutely nothing until they get inside a living cell. So they're parasites, and they, in order to reproduce themselves, they have to get inside a living cell. They have to hijack all the protein-making apparatus and all the rest of it to reproduce themselves. And that's how they survive, you know, and then they've got to jump to another susceptible person and infect them and on in a never-ending chain of infections in order to survive.
Mm-hmm. So one way to think about viruses, I don't know if this does damage to the concept, is that they are just the information for replication.
Yes, that's exactly what they are.
Yeah, they are DNA, really. Yeah, or is it
RNA?
I can't remember. RNA, yeah, that's
right. Some of them have RNA genomes.
Yeah, and so they're completely parasitic on
absolutely
cellular
yes.
beings. That's exactly,
yes.
yeah.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And the relationship between these viruses and beings that have cells, I don't know what to call those, it's very old, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, some people say, you know, which came first, bacteria or viruses, but you can't have a parasitic organism evolving first because it's got to be parasitic on something.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, there had to be cells around when viruses, as we know them, evolved.
Mm-hmm. And these viruses are everywhere. And when I say everywhere,
absolutely,
I mean really
yes. I mean,
everywhere.
We used to think, you know, because originally they were being isolated from people who were sick, looking for the cause of their illness, we used to think, you know, that they just cause diseases. But in fact, they're absolutely everywhere. They're in the sea. You know, there are something like 4 times 10 to the 30 of them in the sea. That some geek has worked out that if you lined them all up together, they'd cover 10 million light years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're everywhere, basically. And they're, you know, they're not all causing disease, at least not enough. They're controlling the bacterial populations in the seas, and they're controlling bacterial populations in our guts.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they are quite useful.
Mm-hmm. There's something remarkably admirable about their simplicity and beauty, I think. I mean, obviously, they're terrible when they cause disease, but they're
I think they're absolutely fascinating. Yeah. I wouldn't have spent my whole life working on them if I didn't.
They're
incredible.
Yeah, they are.
I mean, the word clever, one shouldn't say, because, you know, they don't know. They haven't got a brain. They're not working things out, but they're fantastic.
Right.
The way that they spread from one person to another is absolutely essential for their lifestyle. Otherwise, they'll just die out.
And
the ways that they have evolved to spread from one person to another is extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you mentioned how they spread and things like this. Cells, most cells at least, have many, many layers of mechanisms to make sure that things like viruses don't get in them. But the viruses always get in them. How do they, you know, for example, cell walls are particularly designed for this, but the viruses seem to get through the cell walls. How do they do that?
Well, the thing is that viruses can evolve so much quicker than we can, and they mutate so quickly, you know, that if one of them can't get in, then another one that's mutated slightly probably can.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the DNA, for example, of HIV mutates a million times more quickly than our DNA mm-hmm. mutates.
Yeah.
So really, we're always on the back foot. You know, they're always one step ahead.
Yeah. So that brings up the question, if they're changing so quickly, how do we divide them into clean types? Or can we do that?
Yes, because, I mean, first of all, it was done on the structure of the virus particle because they look different. But obviously, more recently, it's done on the genome sequence.
Mm-hmm.
And they do have genes which are typical of particular virus families.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So HIV belongs to the retrovirus family, for example, and you can recognize it because of the structure of its genome.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So just again, on kind of background information, and again, this may sound like a really simple question. Why is the HIV virus deadly in humans? What does it do?
It's deadly because it infects the particular cell, which is a CD4 lymphocyte, which is absolutely critical for our immune response.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it's infected and knocked off enough of them, we just can't produce an immune response to it.
Mm-hmm.
Or neither can we produce an immune response to any other infectious organism.
Right, so the bacteria,
as you know, people with AIDS actually die of opportunistic infections because the virus has knocked off their immune system.
Right.
That's it.
And in many cases, the bacteria, for example, that are allowed to multiply and things like this, they're already in us.
Absolutely.
Because we're hosts to lots of bacteria.
Yes,
they help
absolutely.
Us every day.
And viruses.
And viruses, yeah. Yeah, that's particularly, I don't know what to say about that. That's And so it evolved, essentially, to infect these particular kinds of cells.
Well, it's been doing that for millennia in its previous host, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Retrovirus, mm-hmm. yeah. So, okay, so the French discover it, and some people start to work on the origins of this thing. Did anybody have an initial hypothesis as to where it came from? Or,
I mean, most of our new, in inverted commas, infections come from animals. So I suppose, you know, it was thought that it must have jumped from somewhere. And then one of these coincidences happened, often happen in science and give you a lead, happened. And that was that monkeys at some primate centers in the United States started coming down with an AIDS-like illness.
Mm-hmm.
And the scientists isolated virus from those animals, and it turned out to be a retrovirus, which was very similar to HIV.
Mm-hmm.
It was called simian immunodeficiency virus.
Mm-hmm.
And so that pointed the finger at primates, basically. And at the same time, West Central Africa appeared to be the sort of place where the epidemic had been going on the longest in Africa, and so primate in West Central Africa became the focus of the virus hunters, basically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, there's controversy all over AIDS and HIV. We know, for example, that some scientists and some people who are not scientists disagreed with those who said that AIDS was caused by HIV. Were there people that disagreed that it came from the simian HIV that said, no, this can't be? Was there any sort of controversy around it?
I think there's not particular controversy about whether it the animal it came from,
mm-hmm.
Which is the chimpanzee. But there was controversy about how, there still is, about how it jumped from the chimpanzee to humans.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that. How was?
Okay, right.
Yes, let's talk about that. How, you know, again, there are many sort of scenarios present themselves, but. How did they go about studying this question, the people that were interested?
Well, the fact is that none of us are ever going to know the answer.
Yeah.
But it seems that in West Central Africa, where we assume that it jumped from chimpanzees to humans, the local people do hunt primates and indeed hunt chimpanzees. And therefore, the most likely theory, and most people believe, is the so-called the cut hunter theory, that, you know, some hunter was hunting, killing, butchering a chimpanzee, and you only have to get a small amount of blood, you know, into a cut or an abrasion or something for the virus to transfer. And so that seems the most likely scenario.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
However, there are a few, well, there was a hypothesis called the OBP hypothesis, which is the oral polio vaccine hypothesis. Which suggested that in the 1950s, when polio vaccine was being made in the laboratory, it was grown in monkey kidney cells.
Mm-hmm.
And so this hypothesis suggested that maybe chimpanzee cells were used, and maybe they were infected with the virus, mm-hmm. and maybe it got into the vaccine, and maybe during one of the early vaccine trials, which indeed was carried out in the area of West Central Africa, that was the sort of hotspot, maybe it transmitted that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But in fact, when scientists worked out exactly when the virus jumped to humans, the date just didn't line up, because these trials were being done in the 1950s, and it turns out that the virus jumped much earlier than that, somewhere around 1900, in fact.
Yeah, let's talk about that in just a second, because that's a fascinating story in itself, how they figured that out.
Absolutely,
it really is a fascinating story. I can't wait to hear you talk about it. Most people will say, well, you know, how in the heck is a virus that's adapted to attack the immune systems of chimpanzees, how's it going to jump the phrase that occurs to me is species barrier, if there is such a thing. How does it do that?
You mean, how did it manage to get a hold on?
Yeah, in other words, if it was adapted to chimpanzees, humans are different than chimpanzees. So
yeah, but only 2% or something, mm-hmm. at the DNA level.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are our closest relatives.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, you know, we are very closely related to them, and it just so happens that the molecule that this virus uses to get into chimpanzee lymphocytes, that is CD4 molecule, is very, very similar to the CD4 molecule on our lymphocytes.
Mm-hmm.
Similar enough for the virus not to know the difference.
Is that right? That's interesting.
Yes.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. Well, I mean, this goes back to the, you know, people will often say that humans share, I don't know, some outrageous percentage, 98% of their genes with chimpanzees. But isn't it the case that we share something like 50% of our genes with earthworms? Or something like this?
Yes, but there's a difference between 50 and 98%.
Yeah, right. Well, the thing I don't
think earthworms have CD4 lymphocytes.
No, they don't. The thing I'm trying to point out here, though, is that the basic mechanisms, the kind of things that work, they stay.
That's true.
Right. And so their cellular mechanisms are exactly like ours. Not exactly, but pretty much exactly like ours, because these are just the building blocks of any multicellular life.
Yeah, sure. But as you get more complex, mm-hmm. the sophistication of the immune system is just incredible, you know. And so ours obviously would be most similar to chimpanzees, and that's what's happened, really. But uh-huh. you know,
yeah, no, that's right. Yeah, so it was pretty easy to jump the species barrier. Now let's go to this question we just mentioned, and that is how did they figure out when it jumped?
Well, as I said, these viruses mutate very quickly. And so if you start with one virus and it produces offspring, you know, 24 hours later, those are all producing offspring. So you've got literally billions of the things, and they're all slightly different. So they're all mutating all the time. And you can track back, following these mutations backwards, and work out the time at which the population that you've got all arose from a single virus. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And so in a sense,
because the mutations occur at regular intervals.
Right.
You know, yes.
I was going to say, it's like a clock.
It is like a clock. Right. It's called the molecular clock.
Yeah, it's ticking at a regular interval.
Yes.
So the
yes.
more ticks you have, the older it is.
Exactly.
Right.
Yes.
And this occurs in humans, of course, as well. We can track the number of mutations in human DNA. And this helps us, for example, explain how old certain features are, and also descent groups and things like this.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Which actually is amazing.
Of course, the problem was that by the time we got to know that HIV was around, it was incredibly diverse because it had actually been in Africa for, 100 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And so what scientists had to do was try and find what they call fossil viruses, old viruses. And of course, unfortunately, viruses don't leave fossils, but what they were looking for was viruses that had, like insects preserved in amber, they'd been mm-hmm. preserved from earlier times. And because West Central Africa, and in particular the Democratic Republic of Congo, seemed to be the place where it had sort of started its life, they went to Kinshasa, the capital of the Democratic Republic of Congo, and searched around for early pathological samples.
Mm-hmm. And what did they find?
Well, unfortunately, they'd had a couple of wars, and their electricity had not been working for a while, and so they'd lost all their early blood samples that had been stored, for example. And eventually, they found one collection of blood samples which had been taken in the Democratic Republic of Congo but had been stored in the United States. And just one of those samples was HIV positive.
Mm-hmm.
And that was a sample taken in 1959. And they managed to rescue virus sequences from that.
Mm-hmm.
But in order to compare, you really need two. So then they found one in the Democratic Republic of Congo in a pathological sample, which a biopsy of a lymph node that had been taken from somebody in 1960. And those don't have to be stored frozen. They were just stored at room temperature. So mm-hmm. they managed to get a virus out of that. And comparing those two showed that already by 1960, they were pretty diverse.
Mm-hmm.
And the number of mutations had that were different between the two of them could be used to trace back to say that it probably jumped around 1900.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. It's kind
so
of
it's an incredible bit of detective work. Really.
Yeah, it's kind of like triangulation in a certain way, if you think about it like that. And so they trace it back to this this place, Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo. I can't remember what they're calling it now. And to around 1900.
Well, no, that's not quite correct, because the earliest virus they found there was 1959.
Mm-hmm.
Did I say? Yes.
Yeah, you did.
And so using those viruses, they traced the origin or the jump back to 1900. But that's not to say that happened
in Congo.
Kinshasa.
In Kinshasa.
It happened, they now think, in the southeast corner of Cameroon.
Mm-hmm. And why is that?
because having isolated lots of viruses from primates, they pointed the finger at the chimpanzee, and one particular subspecies of chimpanzee seemed, this is work that's done on captive chimpanzees, mm-hmm. So one particular subspecies seemed to be the one that had the virus most related to HIV, and this group then decided to do field studies on these animals in the wild to see whether they carried the virus, which was obviously important. And they did a field study in 10 different sites in the Cameroon on communities of chimpanzees. And they couldn't use blood samples because chimpanzees are a protected species. They're on the endangered species list. So they spent 2 years refining a technique of extracting viral sequences from feces that the chimpanzees had produced. I mean, it's astonishing. And by the end of the 2 years, they not only could they get the virus out of these fecal samples, they could also tell the species, the subspecies, and even track individual animals from the DNA that they got out of the feces.
That's amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So they found in their 10 different communities of chimps, 5 of the communities had animals that carried the virus, and just 2 had two of the communities had animals that carried the virus that was most similar to HIV, that they said, you know, that it had to be the direct ancestor of HIV. Mm-hmm. And these two communities of chimpanzees lived in the very southeast corner of the Cameroon.
Mm-hmm.
So there you are. It's quite astonishing. I think they'll be coming up with the actual chimpanzee any minute now.
It's pretty amazing. So what is that? What happens to chimpanzees with HIV? How do they?
An interesting story, actually, because normally if an animal has been infected by a virus for a very long time, a balance is sort of, you know, and so the virus generally doesn't cause a serious illness. And one might expect, for example, that HIV in hundreds of years' time will cause a less severe illness in humans. But anyway...
And this is due to sort of fill in the blanks here, this is due to selection.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so there's some individuals
that are born... To the advantage of both the virus and the humans.
Uh-huh.
You know, that the virus, if it kills its host, it has to move on. Mm-hmm. So it's in its interest not to.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously it's in the interest of humans not to be killed by it. So...
Mm-hmm.
A sort of balance is struck normally, but as it turns out, chimpanzees do get an AIDS-like illness with this virus. And to complicate the story more, this seems to be because it's actually quite a recent infection of chimpanzees.
Mm-hmm.
And when the molecular biologists looked at the genome of the simian immunodeficient virus in chimpanzees, they discovered it was actually a hybrid of two monkey viruses. This is getting a bit complicated.
I'm following.
They sort of now postulate that somewhere, maybe about 1,000 years ago, chimpanzees are carnivores and they live on smaller monkeys. So maybe a chimpanzee was eating, you know, two separate types of monkeys and got both their retroviruses, and they recombined in the chimpanzee to cause to form this new virus, which has then spread among chimpanzee populations.
Mm-hmm. So just to rehearse a little bit, in the interest of clarity, I'm trying to think where to start. So we know this population of chimpanzees has something a little bit like human HIV. We call it simian HIV. We know that they passed it to humans somewhere in Cameroon, probably around 1900. And then we're speculating that... it's a young infection because it hasn't reached what we might call it an equilibrium in the population.
Yes.
In other words, it hasn't reached that stability that we see with lots of viruses, because it's not in the interest of the virus to kill all the hosts, obviously. So there would be adaptation on the part of the through selection on the part of the chimpanzees. And so the hypothesis is that the chimpanzee combined two retroviruses by eating the meat of two different monkeys, and then they sort of glom together. So my question is now, do viruses do that? Do they stick together like that?
Yes. If two viruses, I mean, flu viruses doing it all the time, if two viruses infect the same cell, then their genes may get muddled up and they'll come out being, you know, hybrids of each other.
That's kind of interesting because it reminds me of sexual reproduction.
Well, yes.
You see what I'm saying? It's like viruses don't have sexual reproduction, obviously.
The next best thing.
Yeah, viruses just have us beat on in every way, don't they? They have, But I mean, just for the listeners, you know, because our genes will change as a result of a mutation, but they also change as the chromosomes change as a result of recombination and things like this.
Absolutely.
And what we're talking about here is a mechanism, an accidental mechanism. Aren't they all accidental? That the viruses have come upon to actually take advantage of recombination in addition to mutation. That's pretty impressive.
And HIV is doing that as well. I mean, if one individual, it's quite common. There are all these recombinant forms, so-called, of HIV circulating now, which means that one person got infected by two different strains of the virus, and they recombined in that person to form a third strain, basically.
Mm-hmm. So can we take the story back any further than the agglomeration of these two retroviruses, say, 1,000 years ago? Is there any way to take it further?
I don't think so, really. I mean, that event hasn't been timed very accurately.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to remember the names of the two monkeys. One was called the spot-nosed monkey, I think, and the other, I can't remember. Anyway, some kind of a mangabee, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so, obviously, the genomes of those viruses have been looked at, and it's quite clear to see that bits of those viruses are present in the chimpanzee mm-hmm. virus and also in the human virus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but exactly timing these things, it gets more difficult as you know, as it goes further and further back,
mm-hmm.
really.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So let me ask this. How does all this historical knowledge help us deal with HIV today?
Well, it's background understanding, really, isn't it? And if you were asking me how it helps us, stop the epidemic in its tracks or things like that, maybe the answer is it's not awfully helpful. But it is very important to know what these viruses are doing out there, because mm-hmm. At any minute, another one may jump.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I haven't mentioned it yet, but, there isn't just one HIV. In fact, there are 12 of them,
mm-hmm.
And each one has jumped separately from primates to humans.
Mm-hmm.
And so, it's not just a one-off event. It happens in these places. And so it might happen again tomorrow. And I think, we just really need to be aware of what are dangerous occupations, how we might help people who are hunting these animals, and how we might prevent it in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And the more we know about it, then the more we can work like that.
Mm-hmm. I think one thing it does, if I could just chime in here for a second, mm-hmm. Is that it squelches or squashes other much less likely hypotheses about the origins of AIDS. I mean, maybe you don't have this in the UK, but there are people who say that AIDS came from all kinds of places in the United States. And so just the knowledge that it came from here, I think is an arrow in the quiver of those people that want to deal with it in a kind of scientific fashion. We've shown where it came from, and it didn't come from, I won't be specific, but that this is the most likely scenario and not one of these other ones that you have, currency in the United States. And they usually take a kind of conspiratorial form. I don't know if you guys have them in the UK, but we have them here.
We hear about them.
And so I think this just this knowledge, this historical knowledge really helps those of us who want to deal with it in a kind of rational scientific fashion.
No, I agree with that. Yeah.
So, historians say this kind of thing all the time. But then, you're right. Occupationally speaking, there are probably still people in the bush that hunt chimpanzees, right?
Oh, there certainly are, yeah.
Yeah, and we can tell them that, this may not be the safest thing that you want to do.
No, and I mean, there are other viruses out there. That's the other thing that people are doing now, is looking to see what else there is out there. And, of course, there's a whole menagerie out there.
Uh-huh.
We take, hundreds of years to sort of map all these viruses, but at least it's the beginning, and at least we know what we should be doing.
Well, you talk about the I think of HIV as a thing. It is one thing, but as you say, there are different kinds of it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes. Well, there's HIV-1 and HIV-2, which are really quite okay. They're both retroviruses, but they're quite different from each other, and they came from different types of animals. So HIV-1 and the whole family and its whole family came from the chimpanzee, while HIV-2 came from the Sutinangabe monkey.
Mm-hmm.
And it is extraordinary they both sort of appeared at the same time, but nevertheless, it's quite clear that they both jumped from separate animals to humans. And then when people started studying HIV-2, it turned out that there are at least 8 different subtypes of that, and that they have each jumped from Sutimangaris to humans on different occasions. Now, those viruses have not caused a pandemic. They've stayed local to West Africa, where the Sutimangabe lives.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's that group. Then the HIV-1 group has jumped. There's HIV-1 group O, M, N, and P.
Mm-hmm.
And those are 4 separate jumps from chimpanzees to humans,
uh-huh.
and in fact, one probably from a gorilla. And but only one of those has caused the pandemic. So it's HIV-1 group M, which is the pandemic virus.
Uh-huh.
The others have stayed local.
I see. Uh-huh.
And there's another question we need to ask: why is it that one of them managed to go global, and the others have not?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's another piece of information that would be very useful when we're trying to control another outbreak.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I suppose that the goal for those working on HIV as a vaccination, right? Does the fact that there are many different kinds make producing a vaccination for it more difficult?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the fact that it mutates so quickly makes it difficult, but the fact that there are these different types and subtypes and all the rest makes it very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be that they'll have to make a different vaccine for you know, different areas of the world, really, where the virus has spread to.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But we just don't know, really. And then, actually, that's what I was going to say about knowing about these ancestral viruses that we were talking about. That knowledge might also come in useful when trying to make a vaccine,
mm-hmm.
because if you can find a sequence in one of these ancestral viruses that is common to all of its offspring,
uh-huh.
then obviously that would be a good one to use to make a vaccine from.
Uh-huh, uh-huh, uh-huh.
But,
if you found a primate population, like a chimpanzee population, that had HIV-1 but was asymptomatic of AIDS.
Yes.
Yeah.
That would certainly be something to study to
yeah.
see how it was managing to contain the virus.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But it does seem that they do actually get an AIDS-like illness.
Uh-huh, I see, yeah. So
as far as the vaccine is concerned, you know, it's really, I don't think we can be all that optimistic.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly not for the near future anyway.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, that's sad. I guess one thing that occurs to me, I don't mean to be controversial about this, but do we, when we're testing vaccines and other sorts of treatments, do we use chimpanzees that have HIV-AIDS?
Sorry, the phone was beeping. I didn't hear the question.
I'm sorry. Let me ask again. When we are testing vaccines, if we test them, I think we do, and other treatments for HIV/AIDS, do we test them on chimpanzees that have HIV/AIDS?
No, I don't think that's the case anymore.
Huh.
I mean, they certainly have been looked into as an animal model, but you know, because they're an endangered species,
yeah.
they certainly in the UK, you know, we just don't use them anymore. And I think that's not quite the state of affairs in America. I think you are still allowed to use them, but I think they're being phased out, really.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I think it was researchers were quite shocked when they discovered that they're only 2% of their genome is different from ours, you
yes.
know, and people then started to think, you know, they appear to suffer from similar sort of anxiety states and depression and all the rest as we do. And I think it's become... you know, fairly general, the feeling that we shouldn't really be experimenting on these animals.
Well, along the same lines, when we have a chimpanzee in captivity that has HIV and then manifests AIDS, do we treat them?
That hasn't actually happened.
Uh-huh. Oh,
they've
okay.
been observed in the wild.
I see.
And that's where, you know, they've been seen to come down with immunodeficiency.
Uh-huh. I see. One question I had was, all of this research seems so incredibly important and so productive, really, of new and useful knowledge. In your opinion, is it funded sufficiently? I don't want to get you into hot water here.
Well, being a scientist, I think I would say that nothing is funded sufficiently. You know, and this work has taken 30 years. You know, what we're summarizing here in half an hour has really been 30 years' work for these
mm-hmm.
people. But, you know, the research groups talking about in the book are well-funded because they're world-famous, they're doing fantastic work, you know, and they do get funding.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm sure they would say that if they had more, they could certainly do things maybe faster, and, you know. So there's always a hassle over funding for scientists, I'm afraid.
Well, anybody who can identify and trace the origins of a virus in monkey poop or chimpanzee poop, deserves to sit at my table. I
quite agree.
Yeah,
I mean, they're
absolutely
dedicated, you
yeah.
know, and they've come up with the most amazing information, which is
mm-hmm.
just, I think, anyway, extraordinary.
Yeah, no, I agree with you completely, and kudos to them, and kudos for you for writing the book. We've taken up a lot of your time today, and I really appreciate it. Dorothy, I want to ask our traditional final question on the New Books Network, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, as a matter of fact, I am working on another book, and that's on my favorite virus, the one that I've spent my life working on, Epstein-Barr virus. I'm writing it with a colleague because it's the 50th anniversary of the discovery of that virus next year. It was the first human tumor virus to be discovered,
mm-hmm.
and we're writing the book to be launched at the 50th birthday party that we're going to be running for the virus.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so I hope people will come along.
Well, I hope we can interview you again, because you've been really terrific, and I really enjoy these sorts of stories. And you know, I think that people should know more about this kind of stuff.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, and absolutely. I've enjoyed talking to you as well.
All right, great. Well, today we've been talking with Dorothy Crawford about her book, Virus Hunt, The Search for the Origin of HIV. I want to thank everybody for listening to this podcast. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of New Books Network. And again, thanks. But I especially want to express my appreciation for Dorothy Crawford for being on the show today. Thanks, Dorothy.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.